You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the cost of employer-based health insurance keeps going up for employers and workers. We'll get the details from the author of a new report. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. There are some big early voting numbers in parts of Wisconsin. The Milwaukee Health Department is under criminal investigation in the wake of a scandal involving its lead testing program. And citizens in Door County are hoping to establish a national park in their area. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He is based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, we've got this election coming up not too far off now, and early voting is going on. People are watching for early voting numbers. What kind of information do we have out there so far, Rob?
So let me preface this by saying that these numbers are public information. They're interesting. It's a perfectly fine topic to talk about on the radio. But the next thing I want to say is that we can talk about the numbers. No one has any idea whatsoever what they mean
right.
for the actual elections. We can get into that. But to answer the question, the Urban Milwaukee columnist Bruce Murphy on Thursday was reporting on this, and totals from Madison and Milwaukee are high. More than 16,000 people in Madison had voted, more than 10,000 in Milwaukee. Basically, it looks like early voting is going to increase above 2014 totals, which is the right comparison because that's the last midterm.
And those are big Democratic strongholds, so a lot of people might look at those numbers and either hope or fear that that means there's higher Democratic turnout. That doesn't mean that's what's going on necessarily, though.
Right. I mean, exactly. Democrats want to look at these numbers and see signs of voter enthusiasm. And, of course, there are lots of signs of Democratic voter enthusiasm, not least of which is that in public polls, when you ask people, are you enthusiastic about voting, Democrats in Wisconsin score higher on that than Republicans this year at this time. So the idea behind sort of looking at this some part of tea leaves is that this would show that the Democratic base is so fired up to vote that they can't even wait until November 6th. And that could be true. Certainly in individual cases, it is true. But the other thing about these two places, these two Democratic strongholds, Milwaukee and Madison, is that they are also the largest cities in the state, and therefore the places most likely to have the longest lines on election day. So for some people, it might not be so much about like their own enthusiasm as it is that, man, last time I went to vote, I was late to pick up my kid, and I had to stand in line. It was a whole thing, and this is a way to avoid that headache.
So it is a tea leaf. I mean, I'm looking at my tea bag broke here for the tea I'm drinking. That these tea leaves might be just as valuable in predicting the election as early voting numbers.
That's about right. Now, that said, this is a thing. I mean, campaigns encourage this, especially Democratic campaigns. I think Barack Obama, that is the former president, Rob, who was in Milwaukee today. One of the things that they do at Democratic campaign rallies is to hold early voting events, take people to early voting things. And the idea from the point of view of the campaigns is that if you take your most politically involved people, get their, sort of bank those votes, then they on election day can like help drive people around. They can canvass for votes. Or whatever they need to do to help turn out people on election day, and that's smart if you're a campaign. It's just that it's just we should all be very cautious about seeing the early voting numbers as a harbinger of what we'll see on November 6th.
Keep watching that. We're talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin about some of the big stories in Wisconsin this week. Turning to Milwaukee, Rob, it was revealed this week that the Milwaukee Health Department is under some kind of criminal investigation by the county's district attorney. First of all, how did this come out?
Right. So what is new this week is the Milwaukee City Council President Ashanti Hamilton disclosed it in a response to a some criticism from another council member. We don't know many details about the investigation. We haven't seen any charges out of this, but But this, it exists in the context of the city council is trying to get some testimony from the former health commissioner about the city's lead abatement program. So one result of this is that it's been a reminder of news from earlier in the year of this many difficulties, problems, negligence in Milwaukee's lead abatement program.
And the big accusation or the big concern is that that department under the previous leader of that department didn't appropriately deal with reports and tests showing lead contamination for kids in the city, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, we know lead in drinking water is a very serious public health problem, especially for children. The actual health effects are really bad and very long term. Milwaukee had a program that was intended to address this and follow up and make sure kids were getting, the actual lead in their blood was reduced, and that they were getting the services that they needed to try to recover from lead poisoning. And what this state report that came out in May found was that out of more than 100 cases over 5 years, 90% of the time the city would just close the cases before it saw the actual amount of lead in kids' blood drop to levels that the public health authorities had said was safe. So that's bad. The city's been in the process of reviewing hundreds of cases from the same period to try to find out, make sure that kids are getting what they need, and it's been the subject of a lot of fighting among the city leaders sort of about the way forward.
And then finally, Rob, you pointed us toward a story that I got to say was not on my radar at all. Super interesting, though. A group of citizens pushing for the creation of a new national park in the Door County area. What's going on?
Right, yeah. Liz Welter out of our Door County Bureau is reporting on this. Yeah, this is a push by residents to make the public lands on these five islands, northern islands off Door County, into a national park. People probably know Washington Island if you've sort of visited the area, but there's a string of other islands there. One is actually owned by Michigan. And it turns out 50 years ago, there had been a recommendation by the U.S. Department of Interior to convert these public lands into a national park, and then for whatever reason it just fell apart. Nothing ever came of it. And here's a push to revive that and try to sort of, there's a whole process to it, but they're trying to get the ball rolling on making this a new national park.
And there are a lot of people, it sounds like, and organizations in the area on board with this idea.
Right. I mean, there are benefits that come from this, some of which are environmental. It's there are protections for these lands. The lands are, have environmental significance. They're part of the migratory route for birds, and there are endangered species habitats and so on. But I mean, I think probably one large reason why many residents are advocating for this is that it is an economic boon to be a national park. And Door County, which already has a big tourist economy, sees that, makes the case, these advocates make the case, that it would be worth maybe tens of millions of dollars or at least a large amount in additional revenue as thousands of visitors who want, they want to go see, people like to go see the national parks. And this would bring more people to this part of the world.
And as we wrap up, Rob, this isn't something that's going to happen overnight. You mentioned there are steps. Can you talk about roughly how long something like this could take, assuming it doesn't get tabled and picked up again in another 50 years?
Yeah, right. I mean, this is right. It's a bit hard to say, but the first formal step is that Congress needs to request that the National Park Service conduct a resource study, and then that study itself takes 2 years, and then they just, the National Park Service would decide whether they agree or want this as a national park. Ultimately, it's Congress. Congress would have something to do. Would have to pass a law to make this happen. But it might be the rare case where, it doesn't have a particular ideological valence here. If the people want it and there's a good environmental case for it, it could actually happen in a few years.
We'll watch for that in the years to come. Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Robert Menzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He was with us for a weekly look at news from around the state. Coming up, we talk to a co-author of a report that shows healthcare costs rising for employers and employees. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is getting a lot of high-profile political visits in the run-up to Election Day, but do big-name appearances and endorsements from politicians or celebrities really make a difference? We'll tackle that question coming up. First, if you've been paying attention to the political fights over the Affordable Care Act, you've probably heard a lot about Medicaid expansions or plans sold on the individual exchange markets. But a majority of Americans get their insurance from their employers, and those plans are seeing changes too. The Kaiser Family Foundation recently released a new report detailing what's been happening with those employer-sponsored plans this year. Matthew Ray is a senior policy analyst at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello?
Matthew, are you there?
Sorry, the phone just cut out.
Okay, I'm hearing you now. And you're hearing me. Great, wonderful. So these employer-sponsored healthcare plans, they don't get as much media attention sometimes in the political debate, but they're really important. Most Americans have their plans through their employer, right?
Absolutely. 150 million Americans get their health insurance through an employer.
And you've been doing this survey for two decades now. What have been the long-term trends for costs for employer-based healthcare?
Well, we've seen so much volatility in so many of the other health insurance markets. Things have been relatively consistent for employers over the last couple of years, at least. So we continue to see sort of slow but steady premium increases, which over time add up to big dollar amounts for employers. But in any given year, are these sort of sticker shock prices that we see in the for people buying insurance in the non-group market or buying health insurance on their own.
And who ends up paying for this? How much is it split between what the employers pay and what the employees pay?
No, it's a great question. There's a tremendous amount of variation. Some employers pay the entire premium. Other employers are asking employees to pay a tremendous amount of the premium. But on average, the employer and the employee are splitting the premium at a similar percentage over time. So on average, for single coverage, the employee pays about 18% of the premium in 2017, which is roughly similar to what it was years ago.
And you've been
but that 18% matters because the premiums they're worth a lot of money now. So the average premium for single coverage now is closing in on $7,000, and for a premium for a family of four is almost $20,000. $20,000 is a lot of money, no matter how you cut it.
And you've been tracking this, as I said, for a couple of decades now, and so you have a before and after the Affordable Care Act. They've been going up the whole time. Did anything change as far as the trends when the Affordable Care Act got passed?
Yeah, so the Affordable Care Act kind of was filling in a lot of the gaps around the employer system. So in some ways, the Affordable Care Act impacts what employers are doing. You know, large employers now have to offer health benefits, but almost all of them already were. There are some minor differences, like employees now have shorter waiting periods, or they are required to have a waiting period of less than 90 days before they can enroll in coverage. And out-of-pocket maximums, which is the most money that employees can spend out of pocket on health spending in a year, that's been capped. But these, I guess, are kind of the periphery issues to the system. In terms of cost and employer offer rates and who's eligible in coverage, we haven't seen a lot of changes over the last 10 years. Things have been remarkably consistent, although, you know, there are longer-term trends that kind of existed before and after the ACA. Employers still have to figure out ways to pay for what is an incredibly expensive benefit.
Matthew Ray is with us from the Kaiser Family Foundation talking about a new report on the costs of healthcare. We're focusing on employer-sponsored plans. They don't get always as much attention, but a lot of Americans get their health insurance through their employer. The report finds long-term costs are going up. They're being held by the employers and the employees. And Matthew, do we know what is driving the increase in these costs over the years?
Yeah, so it's kind of like a good news, bad news story, right? The good news is that we're seeing a relatively low premium increase. So this year, family premiums increased 5% from 2017, which, you know, is much less than the sort of premium increases we see for people buying coverage on their own or the premium increases we saw in the early 2000s. So in some ways, that's a good story. The bad news is that 5% still adds up over time to a lot of money. In terms of why we're seeing cost growth at the rate we are, is it's a balance. When employers get a premium increase, they have to make decisions over their plans. So they make changes to their plans to try to reduce cost. So we've seen things like increasing deductibles, which has the effect of decreasing the premium and that the employer has to pay for the coverage. But ultimately, like, premiums are driven by one of two things, right? How many services are covered and how much those services cost. So increases in premiums are because the actual cost of delivering care is really expensive in lots of parts of the United States.
And that's been a criticism of the Affordable Care Act, that it covered who covers health care, who pays for the insurance, but didn't always tackle those underlying cost increases. Do we know what is making annual costs of health care go up, and I think go up faster than the rate of inflation?
Yeah, absolutely, faster than the rate of inflation over time. Well, a lot of it's market by market, right? So hospitals and providers will negotiate with insurers and set prices. And that's the prices that the employer will end up paying. So when those prices go up over time, then employers and employees end up paying more through premiums.
And do we know, those bigger employers in particular, they, as these costs go up, they don't necessarily have the option of just dropping healthcare altogether. Is that right?
Well, they can. Under the Affordable Care Act, they'd have to pay a penalty for that. But most employers offered health benefits before the Affordable Care Act. Some 90% of workers are at a firm that offers health benefits. Firms offer health benefits because they want to recruit and retain the best employees, and that's still something employees think of when they're shopping for a new job. Especially now when labor markets are tighter, there's no reason to expect that employers are, especially large employers, are leaving the space. We continue to expect employers to offer coverage.
Now, there have been attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act in Congress. That fell short. There's a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality, I should say, of the Affordable Care Act. Given what you said earlier, would the end of the Affordable Care Act affect the employer-provided health care market all that much?
It's a healthcare system, right? So changing things anywhere will impact things everywhere else. But ultimately, like, employers continue to offer coverage because their employees expect it. So changes, thinking of changes in the healthcare system, like policy, will continue to affect what employers are doing, but not at the core of it.
And I've been asking you kind of about national numbers and national trends. Does it break down differently depending on where you are in the country when it comes to the rising costs of employer-provided healthcare?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Costs vary tremendously across the United States.
And are there...
And even within markets, there's tremendous variation in what workers are paying in terms of deductibles or in terms of what they're contributing towards the premium.
Now, looking at the last 20 years overall, has there been, and you were touching on this earlier, how much has the annual rate of increase changed? Are we seeing, I'm putting this in a weird way, are we seeing decreases in the annual increases?
I know exactly what you mean. Yes, the rate of growth has been slower over the last 5 years than it was 15 years ago. So premiums are growing slower than they were earlier in the 2000s, but they are still growing faster than what workers' wages and inflation are.
And is that...
Which ultimately means that premiums are continuing eating. If we think that employers substitute health benefits for wages, then the interpretation would be that premiums continue to eat into workers' wages.
Well, that's interesting. So I don't know if you dug into this, and particularly in your report, are you seeing these costs of healthcare eating into salary? So great, good news. My costs of health insurance didn't come up if I'm an employee, but I didn't get that raise I might have gotten otherwise.
Yeah, so employers will make that an individual decision, obviously. But the health insurance still costs a lot of money for employers, so I think they take that into consideration when they're compensating workers.
And what kind of trends are you watching for now as we look ahead? Again, some uncertainty in the healthcare marketplace. What kind of things are you watching for now as we go from 2018 into 2019?
So a couple things. I still think that what employees have to pay through cost sharing remains really important. So most workers will face a deductible or a copay or coinsurance before they can use most healthcare services, especially deductibles. We've seen those go up rapidly over time, much outpacing inflation. So that puts additional healthcare costs into people who use services. So if that trend continues, that has meaningful impacts for people who get sick, the sickest workers. I think employers continue to think about how to deliver care in terms of networks and what providers are in their networks and how they can deliver care in more efficient or more cost-effective ways. So thinking over that going forward will be interesting. And I think employers continue to do interesting things with their wellness programs. So many employers now have meaningful financial incentives to encourage you to do health examinations or participate in various wellness programs.
We'll leave it there for now. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
That was Matthew Ray of the Kaiser Family Foundation. He was with us to talk about the group's new research on employer-sponsored health plans, which shows rising costs for premiums and deductibles, costs going up for employers and employees. Coming up, national politicians and celebrities are rallying support for candidates here in Wisconsin and around the country. We'll talk about the impact these endorsements have on voters, if any. And by the way, join WPR tonight at 7:30 for an election special about the big ticket item, the race for Wisconsin's governor. It's hosted by WPR's Sean Johnson and Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg. It features profiles of Republican Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Tony Evers. We'll look at their views on key issues like education, taxes, health care, the economy, and transportation. That's tonight at 7:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Find more election coverage at WPR.org. And, of course, tune in on election night a week from this coming Tuesday. I'll join Frederica and Sean for live details as they come in. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on the morning show, some nurses in Wisconsin are learning Spanish so they can provide care for immigrant workers in rural parts of the state. Find out more with John Munson and his guest Monday at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin is getting a lot of love from high-profile national politicians this election season. Names like Trump, Obama, Pence, Biden, and more are visiting the state in hopes of swaying the voters toward their respective candidates.
Scott fights every day for you, and now we need you to fight for him. And all you have to do is go out and vote.
We are not going to have the lowest midterm voter turnout in history. We are going to have the highest voter turnout.
He wants to repeal Act 10, put Wisconsin back in the fiscal mess that Governor Walker dug it out of. He wants to repeal right to work, deprive Wisconsin workers with freedom in the workplace that's created and contributed to the dynamic economy and the growth that you've seen.
I am here for one simple reason. I am here to ask you to vote. To vote in what might be the most important election of our lifetimes.
In order there, President Donald Trump, Senator Bernie Sanders, Vice President Mike Pence, and former President Barack Obama, all of whom have made stops in Wisconsin lately in the run-up to the midterm elections. If you're running for office, the hope is that support from a well-known celebrity or respected politician of your party can have a significant impact on your campaign. Our next guest is here to talk about how high-profile endorsements can help a campaign or maybe in some cases hurt it. Meredith Conroy is an associate professor of political science at California State University San Bernardino. She's also a senior researcher with the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media. Meredith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, how much do we know about having that high-profile endorsement, in this case from a high-profile politician of your party, really makes a difference with voters?
So when looking at political science scholarship, which is what I am, a political scientist, there isn't a lot. It's hard to assess the degree to which someone, a high-profile person like a president, in this case with Trump, or a former president who's really popular like Obama, the degree to which they're actually swaying voters. I think we know more about how they influence turnout, you know, not necessarily how people vote, but who will vote. And there's definitely evidence to suggest that having a president or a former president come campaign for you can bolster the visibility of your turnout, the viability of your own campaign and candidacy, and also that it suggests the race is competitive. And all three of those things increase turnout. So we know more about how endorsements influence turnout and less so about how they actually change a person's decision, especially in a general election when you have another shortcut. You know, an endorsement is information, but another piece of information is obviously party ID. And in a general election, with that information of party ID, you're probably not going to flip too many voters.
Right. So that high-profile visit, if I'm an undecided voter, or especially if I'm a decided voter, is not going to change my mind, probably.
Right. I think that's right.
And you and some other folks over at 538 looked at what kinds of politicians, and not just politicians, celebrities and organizations, what kind of endorsements might resonate with voters from different parties and independents. And there were some interesting results you found. Can you share some highlights?
Yeah, that was a lot more interesting because during a primary, like I said, you don't have that information shortcut of party identification. So an endorsement carries a lot more weight. And so that is what we were looking at with 538. We were looking at at group endorsements and, like you said, high-profile endorsements during a primary, so how it influenced Democrats' support for other Democrats and Republicans' support for other Republicans. One of the more interesting ones actually was with Leah Vukmir. As someone who doesn't live in Wisconsin and has never lived in Wisconsin, if I were just going off of, you know, looking at who had endorsed Vukmir and who had endorsed her opponent, Nicholson,
Kevin,
is that right?
Nicholson, yep.
Yeah, I would have immediately thought, well, this race is going to go to Nicholson because he had the support of Bannon, of Steve Bannon, who at the time was still popular, more so popular, and then as well as Great America PAC, Club for Growth Money, and on the groups we were looking at, Vukmir had the NRA. And so if I was just looking at those as signals, I would have thought, you know, Nicholson would win. But, of course, Vukmir won in a really competitive race. But overall, some of the more surprising things we saw was that interest groups that traditionally have this influence, like the NRA, in this election cycle weren't necessarily as, if we look at their win record, it wasn't necessarily as high as we might expect. I think about, like, they had a 70% win record or so, 57% win record, excuse me. And that had a lot to do with the fact that they didn't endorse that many candidates, and they endorsed a lot of candidates in the same race. But that one stood out to me as very interesting. Trump did a lot of endorsing during the primary. That's really rare for a president to try and steer a race during a primary instead of waiting until a general. And all the candidates he endorsed won, with the exception of two. That was another interesting thing we observed. But certainly during a primary, endorsements carry a lot more weight, which is why we were so interested in them. And also they signal, you know, what direction the party is going. That was kind of the genesis of the project. We were interested in saying which wing of the Democratic Party is going to emerge in 2018 and which wing of the Republican Party is going to emerge. And we felt like endorsements were a good proxy for those sort of ideological variations.
I know there's a lot of arguments about that, I think, among Democrats and Republicans. When you broke it down, did you see lessons we can learn in either or both parties about which trend within a party was more powerful in this primary season?
So for the Democrats, we found the party still decides. There's a political science book called The Party Decides that was written in 2008 that essentially says the party endorsement kind of picks the winner. And the party, the people that the party, the official party endorsed, did do really well. They won 95% of their races. But the question is the party endorsing candidates that are already going to win? So we couldn't necessarily tease that out. What I thought was more interesting was this surge on the Democratic side of progressive groups like Indivisible is new, Justice Democrats is new, Our Revolution is new. These are all new, very liberal progressive groups, and they were getting involved. And while their candidates, you know, they didn't necessarily have a win rate over 50 or 60%, their candidates are still winning. So I think that says that the Democratic Party, while the party, official party endorsement still won, there is a storm brewing on the left that is going to change the Democratic Party going forward.
Now, celebrities often endorse or campaign with or raise funds for candidates. I don't know how much how effective those are, but one story that got a lot of attention this year is Taylor Swift, not often directly involving herself in politics, made a very specific pitch within her state of Tennessee. Some people looked and said, oh, look, voter registrations jumped up then. What do you make of that particular celebrity endorsement in the 2018 elections?
So, you know, your initial question about do endorsements sway people, this is one where I don't necessarily have any explicit evidence, but you would think that the people who are most likely going to be swayed by an endorsement are people who don't necessarily have a strong affiliation with either party, and that is potentially the 140 or 114 million people who follow Taylor Swift on Instagram. So I do think that beyond just those numbers we saw about this increase in registration rates at vote.org, the link that Taylor Swift shared and still has in her bio on her Instagram page, you know, that I think is an immediate effect that we saw. But I do think the fact that she explicitly endorsed a candidate could potentially influence, you know, who Swifties are voting for in Tennessee, however many there are. You know, it's not something we can look at necessarily right now. I'm sure there's some creative political scientists or communication scholars out there that are going to try to observe the direct impact of Taylor Swift's endorsement for Brenderson and against Blackburn. But I do think it's possible that there's individuals who have such an affinity for Taylor Swift and not necessarily any affinity for the Republican in that race that would maybe switch a vote had they intended to straight ticket vote for Republicans, for example.
We're talking to Meredith Conroy right now. She's an associate professor of political science at California State University San Bernardino. She's with us to talk about the impact endorsements from high-profile people like celebrities maybe, or like President Trump or former President Obama can have on campaigns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As we said earlier, we've had all these high-profile political visits in Wisconsin. Did you go to one of them? What was it like? If you went, you probably knew who you were voting for already, but did it energize you? Did it make you want to do more stuff maybe for the campaign? What do you think of big name endorsements? Do you watch for them? Do you think they make a difference? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time coming up. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the impact that high-profile endorsements and campaign visits can have on elections, especially ahead of this year's midterms. Meredith Conroy is with us, associate professor of political science at California State University, San Bernardino. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gone to any of the high-profile political rallies in Wisconsin over this last couple of weeks? Former President Obama today, President Trump just a couple days ago, the vice president, Joe Biden's coming soon, Bernie Sanders, the list keeps going on and on. Did you go? What did you think about it? And do you think endorsements like these affect you or voters in general? Do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Meredith, with that issue of, you know, you've got the big exciting thing with the president or former president, as you're saying, it may not affect whether or how people vote. Is there anything out there on researching people's political activism after that? If somebody's at this exciting rally, do they volunteer to knock on doors or raise funds or whatever, stuff envelopes?
Absolutely. Things like this will enhance enthusiasm. And once you're increasing enthusiasm and the perception that a race is competitive, people are going to take that next step and become greater, they're more likely to be activists on other measures other than attending a rally. Like you said, people who attend rallies are already pretty engaged. But then they may turn that enthusiasm into knocking on doors or into asking and telling their friends to register or to vote. So I think that the trickle-down effects of these endorsements are definitely powerful, even if you're not explicitly seeing someone at a rally saying, oh, I'm going to change my vote. But they absolutely have an effect, which is why, you know, you see them to such a degree, and especially in Wisconsin. I think another really interesting thing to think about, too, is why is it that Biden is out there endorsing or Sanders is out there endorsing? There's a lot you can learn about the individuals who are taking the opportunity to go to swing states like Wisconsin to do endorsements. They probably also have, you know, some political aspirations of their own, so they can learn a lot about who's doing the endorsing, too.
Now, you mentioned Taylor Swift using her Instagram account. Now, I assume we don't have a lot of data on past Taylor Swift Instagram endorsements because this is the first one. But are we starting to learn about how social media and activism on social media, paying attention to political news on social media, is affecting how and whether people vote?
So this is something, you know, I do study social media use and how it either increases or not political participation. And absolutely, there's this element of, you know, being social on social media that converts people to more social activities offline. So encouraging other people to vote, going to a rally. If you're the social behavior online, absolutely transitions offline. Also, when you think about the degree to which you can see your friends and who they support online, having that much exposure to politics and to your friends' endorsements, which probably are more meaningful to you than Taylor Swift. So that can have an impact on how people vote. Their individual social network and the things that they're seeing within their network is going to influence who they support and the tendency that they're going to vote. There's a social pressure that social media facilitates on individuals that makes them feel like they need to vote because the people in their circle are voting.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Brad with us in Mauston. Brad, hi.
Hi, how are you? Wow, good. I'm such a fan of your program.
Thanks. What'd you want to tell us about, Brad?
I definitely think Donald Trump had a major impact on this upcoming election. As I was telling your operator, I think he's a rock star in the world of politics. I know you yourself aren't necessarily a fan of Donald Trump. If I'm correct, I think you were a Never Trumper at the time.
I haven't taken any opinion either way, Brad, but are you saying Donald Trump has definitely influenced your vote? Does seeing him at his rallies in person or TV get you riled up to vote?
Absolutely. I voted today. I voted early. I hope people get out there and vote. Obviously, I prefer they vote Republican because I think the president's having a tremendous amount of success.
All right, Brad, thanks for the call. Meredith, so is that something we might see? Okay, there's this rally, there's this event, and it gets people out, as Brad did, making that early vote.
So, yeah, I'm sure, you know, the right after you're feeling enthusiastic about your candidate, you're probably going to want to rush to the polls and vote and encourage people around you to vote or encourage other listeners to call into a radio show and vote. I have no doubt that those kinds of experiences lead to enthusiasm, leads to participation in all sorts of ways beyond voting. You know, there are obviously other ways to participate, like telling other people to vote or registering other people to vote. So I imagine that's Trump's strategy with visiting Wisconsin, where there are a lot of close races.
Brad, thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate it. So what are you watching for, Meredith, when it comes to who's going where around the country to back certain candidates?
So I'm watching, obviously it'll signal the competitiveness, but it also will signal how important races are to the parties. You know, they're going to send Trump and the Republicans are going to send Trump and Pence to races that are really important to them. These are going to be states that not only have Senate and House races, but also have governor's races. So Wisconsin is one of those states. Now, not every state has a governor's race this year. But if you have a state where the governor's race, for example, maybe isn't that competitive, but you want to make sure your voters turn out for the Senate or the House races, you're going to send someone like Trump or Obama to get up to get enthusiasm up, to hopefully try and turn what the forecasting models say, maybe, you know, against what it looks like you might lose.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Meredith Conroy, Associate Professor of Political Science at California State University, San Bernardino. She's also a senior researcher with the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media. She joined us today for a look at endorsements from big-name politicians and celebrities and the impact they do and don't have on campaigns. A recent report from United Nations scientists found carbon dioxide emissions need to be cut almost in half by 2030 to prevent the worst effects of global warming. But candidates for Wisconsin governor and U.S. Senate aren't saying much about climate change. Danielle Kading reports on why it's not getting much attention and where they stand.
Scientists say you don't have to imagine what might happen if climate change is not addressed. Communities across Wisconsin witnessed the effects this past summer, according to Paul Robbins. He's director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison.
The changes are increased precipitation in extreme weather events, like the kind we saw down in this part of the state. I mean, real gully washers, 2 inches or more, or 4 inches or more in a 24, 48-hour period. We had 15 inches of rain.
Robbins says there are steps the government can take to address climate change, but the issue has been an afterthought in Wisconsin's campaigns this year.
This is a good problem to have, right?
Asked why she's not talking about climate change, Republican U.S. Senate candidate Leah Vukmir said at a stop in Superior this week that climate change just isn't a top concern she's hearing from voters. She's hearing more about health care, immigration, and taxes.
I have to admit, those are the issues I'm hearing from people the most on. But certainly as somebody who believes we have this beautiful country that, and this globe, this earth that we've been given by God, it's our duty to protect it. And I do believe that obviously there is some change that is occurring to climate. What the cause of that is, there are a lot of questions.
When it comes to talking about climate change, Republicans don't agree with some of the proposed solutions. When asked why he's not saying much about climate change, Governor Scott Walker said his administration has tried to make the state cleaner and greener.
What we've done is change things, reform things to make sure the Department of Natural Resources is out front, aggressively working with property owners, with small business owners and farmers to try and avoid the problems in the first place.
But under Walker, Wisconsin has also sued to block Obama-era plans to curb greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. Walker said the plan could increase costs for ratepayers and businesses by up to $13 billion. And Vukmir argues many environmental policies haven't shown they're making a difference. Democrats haven't talked about climate change much during this race, but they're quick to point out that it's real. At a Wisconsin Broadcasters Association debate, Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin said the effects of climate change are something she's seen firsthand.
I've been twice up to northern counties in 2016 and 2018 just to survey damage from incredibly extreme rain events that have washed out roads and cost local communities, state, and federal resources.
And Democrat Tony Evers says DNR funding cuts are at the root of the state's pollution problems. When asked why he's not talking about climate change, Evers says he's a candidate that knows climate change is real and pointed the finger back at Walker for the removal of climate change language from the DNR's website.
As state superintendent of public instruction, we actually stole the climate change stuff from the DNR website before it was scrubbed, so it still exists in the state of Wisconsin. Clearly, Scott Walker doesn't believe in it.
Still, Evers isn't talking about the climate in his 30-second TV ads. Neither is Baldwin or Walker or Vukmir. It might not resonate with voters, but UW-Madison's Robbins says the state will have to deal with the problem one way or another.
We either pay for this up front by getting through an energy transition to a sustainable outcome, or we're going to pay for it later.
UN scientists estimate it would take $2.4 trillion a year to ward off the worst effects of climate change, the droughts, the flooding, and the food shortages. But they say doing nothing could cost more than 20 times that to deal with climate change later on. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find more election stories at wisconsinvote.org, and we'll have more pre-election coverage coming up Monday on Central Time.